and welcome to another episode of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are going back to Japanese director Yasujirō Ozu and his 1953 classic Tokyo Story, a film that enters some polls as the best of all time. Returning on the show today to talk about Armchair Directors is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So it's interesting. I just realized this is the first time we're together and we're not talking about Alfred Hitchcock.
I know. I hardly know what to do, but I do know a couple of things where Hitchcock is similar to Ozu.
Ooh, okay. We'll have to talk about that. So yeah, when I this once again, just like I talked with Julian about Late Spring just a little while ago. This is the first time I've seen this film. It's very emotional. I think it's a film that I think all of us in some way can connect to.
Yeah, I think it's a universal story about generational gaps and parents getting older and drifting away from their children, and children not taking enough care of their older parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so one thing I was reading about this film was interesting. This was based on an American film called Make Way for Tomorrow. So I was wondering, have you seen that film, or just what are your opinions on it?
I have not seen that film.
Oh, okay.
Have you?
No, I haven't. I just reading about it, so I wonder if you saw it. But so this was another part of Ozu's life cycle trilogy. And so, you know, Late Spring, which I saw, was sort of about, you know, kind of growing into adulthood, you know, moving out of the nest, finding a place out on your own, getting married. And this film is in some ways kind of similar, but it's also about, you know, what happens to children, you know, once they no longer need their parents and when they move on their own. So I don't know, it's what your opinion on the life cycle trilogy, and you feel that this fits into it.
I think of this as the Noriko trilogy because it's three movies where it has Setsuko Hara in it as a character named Noriko, but they're not the same person. It's as if Ozu takes a bunch of characters and character names that he likes, sticks them like dice in a cup, shakes it up, and throws it back out again, and then tells a similar kind of story, but with the same names and sometimes the same characters, although sometimes he mixes those up.
Yeah, and so tell us a little bit about Ozu's career at this time, because I know it was 4 years after he did Early Spring. And so was, you know, at this time, was he getting this critical acclaim in Japan? Was he being like a well-respected director? Was he still somewhat kind of unknown?
He's always been very well-respected in Japan, but I think Tokyo Story is what really put him on the map. It's typical of his movies with his style where the camera hardly moves at all, where you feel like you are sitting on the tatami mat with him, watching things transpire. And he had already established this look and style in his earlier films, but by the time he got to Tokyo Story, people were kind of used to the way he was doing things and were looking forward to another iteration of his favorite stories.
Okay. And so was this film, when it came out, did it hit America? Did like critics see this in America at that time? Did, you know, was it well received and well regarded in America, or was it not seen?
It was actually well publicized, so lots of people saw it. It was for some people the first experience they had of Ozu, and then they went back to see some of his earlier works. So it did well in the U.S. and got a lot of acclaim.
And so was this, as we were talking earlier about Late Spring, we were talking about the obstacles Ozu had to face, because that was still at the time of the American occupation of Japan. And so this was 4 years later. So this is at the time when Americans, the occupation ended, and filmmakers were given more freedom and had to face less censorship.
There was that, but it also has that post-war feel to it. He includes lots of imagery of post-war consumerism. You can see his characters gaining commercial goods and seeking after them and being very selfish, because they have come to the point where they're actually seeking consumer wealth and things.
Yeah, and I think there is a good, excuse me. Yeah, I do think there is a World War II subtext in the film, because I think Noriko, I believe it was referenced that she lost her husband during the war.
That's correct. And there's also a funny scene with two guys in a bar talking about it's a good thing we lost the war, otherwise we would be stuck with our music, but now we have jazz. So, you know, it's sort of an ironic little conversation between them.
Yeah, and I believe also it was World War II at the time where you saw that the children move away from the parents? I mean, in this movie?
characters go? That's not really clear. He doesn't really dwell on the war specifically. He sort of, it's the past, and he's starting with, you know, what's supposed to be current in the 50s. But, I mean, it's obviously, it has to be fresh in people's minds, especially the Noriko character who has lost her husband. But he doesn't really dwell on the fact that the war had happened or that Japan lost.
And so, you know, we talked about this earlier. There's you know, when I was talking about Giuliano, he said that all Ozu films are in some ways kind of the same. And, you know, I saw a lot of, you know, watching Late Spring, I kind of already saw the similar themes in this film with Late Spring. You know, there's the old versus new, the old generation versus the new generation. It's talking about, you know, modern attitudes versus more traditional attitudes and just relationships between parents and children.
It's all character driven. So he does like to revisit the idea of the widowed or the single daughter and her feelings of, quote unquote, abandoning her widowed father to be on his own. And this is a subject he returns to over and over. And sometimes he overlays it with the other topics you were just mentioning, like how parents treat their kids, how kids see their parents. But he does like to revisit that role of women in the movies. And it's interesting because they're not the passive, docile Japanese woman we've been trained to think is the norm. They're really feisty women. And in some ways, he makes chick flicks.
Yeah, they're kind of chick flicks. And you're right, you know, and with like Noriko in Late Spring, you know, she's independent, and you know, she tries to fight, you know, that, you know, she's happy being on her own. She doesn't necessarily need to get married or settle down.
And yet in Tokyo Story, she plays a woman who has been widowed, and she's very lonely, and she has this wonderful conversation with her mother-in-law when she's staying with her, and her mother-in-law encourages her to remarry. And it used to be, the old school way of looking at things was, it would be very disrespectful to assume that there would be any other man besides the war hero that she was married to. But this is a forward-thinking kind of an idea, and it's a very emotional moment in the film between that character and her mother-in-law.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of that is due to the acting of Setsuko Hara. I think she, you know, in this film and Late Spring, she's a great actress. I think she was one of the big actresses of that time in Japan.
She was, and she had an interesting story, actually, because the movie is like, it takes its cues from real life. It was considered very unusual to not get married or have children, which is what she did in the 50s. And people thought that was really strange of her. After Ozu died, she refused to make any more movies. And then the public opinion turned against her then. But she was her nickname throughout her life was the Eternal Virgin. But she had a tough way to go. She was sick in, you know, her early adult years. And her brother, who was a cameraman, she watched die in this freak train accident on set. Oh. So she had a really tough way to go. So she brings that sort of fragility to her roles. I think that's why she's so popular. But she was certainly a favorite of Ozu's.
Yeah, and it was interesting, you know, we brought this up in Giuliano, but it's interesting, like, I remember reading the news, she just died less than a year ago.
She was 95.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, like, you said last film with Ozu, she retired, like, it's 1963. She'd only been, like, 43 when she retired. And it's interesting, I guess, was reading, like, a bit onto her, and she didn't do a lot of interviews. She stayed mostly isolated from the public eye. But one interview, she said she didn't really care for acting that much. It was, and she said that, you know, she just saw a way as to help support her family and everything.
Right. That was her sole reason. Plus, I think she enjoyed being Ozu's muse. But once he was gone, I don't think she had the heart for it anymore.
So, you know, it's really interesting that, you know, the storytelling of the film was pretty unique. A lot of important things happen in the film off screen, like such as when the mother starts becoming very ill on the train. We don't see that. We get that through the telegrams and the phone calls.
Well, that's classic Ozu. He likes to have things happen off screen that he just refers to. Like, meanwhile, back at the ranch, there's two train rides to Tokyo that aren't depicted at all. But I think that's because he's very economical about everything that he shoots.
Yeah, and it's just like in Late Spring where she's trying to get married, but you never see her meet the bride, or you never see the bride at all. I mean, not the bride, the groom at all.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of what he likes to do. It's sort of like it happens in the background or as an afterthought. He doesn't show you everything.
And so, you know, I talked about this earlier. I think, you know, I just really like how relatable this film is. And I think when someone watches this film, I think you examine like whether you're at in life with your connection to your parents, you kind of ask yourself, am I treating my parents right? Am I, treating them with the respect even after I leave them and I'm on my own?
And this couple, this older couple, is very likable. You can't imagine that there was some rift. The children just seem really selfish and mean-spirited, especially the daughter.
Ugh.
The daughter, when her husband says, oh, well, I stopped and bought some cake on the way home for your parents. She's like, oh, this is too good for them, and she stuffs it in her face. No matter what kind of relationship you have with your parents, you can see that that's just, I mean, who does that?
Yeah. The character, Shige, that is one of the most detestable characters I've ever seen in a movie. Because I was watching this film in the library, and when she was just saying that, and it was at the end of the movie when she's like, oh, I want this stuff of hers. I was like, oh my God. I was like groaning with such disgust.
Yeah, she was making off with her mother's clothes at the end. Yeah, that actress, though, does that role so well that if you see Tokyo Story first, it's impossible not to see her in that way when you see her in the other Ozu movies she's been in. And she's been in several, which is also kind of interesting. You see her as the sister-in-law to Noriko's character here. But in other movies, she's the aunt or, a family friend. So you sort of see these characters show up over and over. But it's hard not to take that Shige character with you when you see her in other stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I was looking at her filmography. I know that she was in a couple of Kurosawa movies. Like, the first Kurosawa film I ever watched was Redbeard, and I recognized her as one of the women in Redbeard.
She was also in The Idiot, which was a Kurosawa movie.
Yeah, and also, speaking of Kurosawa, I know Setsuko Hara, even though she's best known as, the actress in the Ozu movies, she was also in a few Kurosawa films.
Actually, I got that wrong. It's it's Tomi, the mother in the film, who is in The Idiot.
And we talk about just sort of the unique storytelling of the film. I thought it was also, his camera movement was interesting. I felt it was very simplistic. And, I don't mean that as an insult. I thought it was a very interesting way of telling the story. It's very static. It never really moves. I saw only one tracking shot. Most of it never moved at all for me. And, it's at the low angle, when they're at, what was it called again?
Tatami level.
And, and the characters, are all in the middle of the frame. It's not like the traditional over-the-shoulder shot. They're right in the middle of the frame, and then sometimes it feels like they're looking right at the camera, so like they're talking at you.
Well, it's unique. It's his unique style, where the camera is usually stationary and positioned to capture the point of view of the person sitting on the floor. Most of the edits are straight cuts. There's no special lenses. There's no cross-cutting. There's no flashbacks. There's no dream sequences. There are no ghosts, there's no samurai, so everything you've come to think is classic Japanese movies isn't in there. But he uses space as poetry, and he does sort of what they call a 360-degree camera sensibility. So you'll have characters exit stage right, and they'll come in a door where you wouldn't think there was a door from the wrong angle, because Japanese houses have all of these sliding screens. So the characters, move around the space in a way that's a little bit untraditional. But he does like to park that camera and not move it. And it's a way of almost looking in at a picture in which the actors sort of come to life in the image. And throughout Tokyo Story, there's a pervasive sound of movement, ticking clocks, churning steamboats, passing trains. Yet within each framed composition, his camera doesn't move. There's just that one tracking shot you mentioned as the camera moves from a brick wall to the image of the elderly couple standing alone at the otherwise crowded spa. And it's the only time I can think of where he's actually moved the camera at all.
Yeah.
He apparently would set up, like Hitchcock, he would picture everything he was going to do before he even showed up. And then he never wavered from his plan. So he had each one of those shots in mind. First, we're going to get a close-up of this character, then we're going to cut to this character, then we're going to do the two-shot. He had everything all planned before he got there.
It's interesting. A connection between Ozu and Hitchcock. You really wouldn't think there would be one, but there is.
Well, here's another one. I always look for the sake scene. There's some drinking game that's waiting to happen in Ozu movies, because there's always some scene of one of the male characters will go out with his buddies, and they'll all get drunk on sake. Makes me think of Hitchcock and his brandy references in all of his movies.
Yeah, and we talk about the camera movement. Also, it's the, you know, the editing is also very simplistic. Like, you know, there's no like transitions, there's no wipes, dissolves, fades, whatever you want to call them. It's, you know, it cuts from one scene to another without any kind of transition. And even like our traditional establishing shots, it's not just like one shot of the place the characters are in and right to it. It's like numerous shots of the place the characters are in and then right to it.
He also, if he wants to let you know that this is a significant change in scene, will add a little bit of music. But you're right, everything is just a jump cut.
It's, you know, do you still feel that, do you think of like, say, a modern audience, somebody who may not be familiar with Ozu, if they watch that, would that feel like distracting to them? Or do you still you think that would, it would work to them, or they like it even more?
I think that it is... It's a figurative reminder that modern life is in perpetual motion and that the beauty of life is often found in standing still. And I think that's hard for people. It's almost a Zen idea to quiet your mind and pay attention to the little details. But if you can, I think the movie opens itself up to audiences today. I think all of the things in it are very contemporary.
Yeah, and like, you know, as a 23-year-old kid, I also can speak. I really liked it, and I didn't think it was like old or outdated or anything like that.
I think it's probably suffers a little bit by being a black and white movie. I think some of Ozu's later movies in color are probably more accessible simply because they're in color.
Yeah, that's the classic argument. Oh, it's black and white, can't watch it.
Right, must be old stuff, must not have anything to do with me.
Yeah, and so another, besides Setsuko Hara, another Ozu regular actor in the film was Chizu Ryo. You know, he kind of like Setsuko Hara, he kind of also plays, you know, the same character, the kind elderly father who, you know, just wants the best for his kids. And, you know, he's always, you know, very likable, and there's nothing really to dislike about the guy.
Yeah, he was in 52 out of 54 Ozu movies, so he was definitely a favorite. And he always plays the same guy, right? A simple, unobtrusive man whose humanity is revealed through the hardships of everyday life. Just a regular guy. I think of him as the Jimmy Stewart character in Ozu movies.
Yeah, just like, oh, in that case, Jimmy Stewart was like the all-American good guy, but, you know, Ryo would be the all-Japanese good guy.
There you go.
Yeah, and so other performances in the film that stick out, I know we talked about Shige as such a horrible, detestable character,
yes,
but...
Haruko Sugimura. Yeah, she's Setsukahara's aunt in Late Spring. And she was also in Tokyo Twilight and Early Summer and Floating Weeds and An Autumn Afternoon, so she was also a big favorite of Ozu's.
So it sounds like he was more of like, say, had an indie, independent like storytelling method than like, say, Kurosawa, who was more about like, you know, the epics, larger than life.
Yeah, he was more of the everyday life guy, where Kurosawa was more the bigger than life.
Okay. And so another thing I was looking at in the recent Sight and Sound poll, I know Vertigo is ranked as the best, but in the poll by directors. Directors from all over the world, not just in America, they actually did rank Tokyo Story as the number one greatest film. So I'm wondering, do you agree with them?
I think that it's one of Ozu's best films. I'm not sure I would pick it as the best one he ever did, because I think he got better after Tokyo Story. And I think that some of the stories about the woman, she's always 28 years old, trying to figure out if she should stay with her parents and take care of them or she should get married. And then their struggle with, wow, it's really, how am I going to do without this daughter who has been taking care of me? I think that's more of a contemporary story that people find fresh than the story of the parents who are visiting and their kids don't want to have anything to do with them. I think that's also a universal story, but I think it puts the audience sort of against some of the characters from the get-go. Sometimes it's fun to follow a villain, but I think the other stories are more gentle and accessible because you don't have to dislike anybody.
Okay. And so, you know, since this film is obviously such a big influence, are there any, like, directors or movies that you would say that you see a little bit of Tokyo Story or even Ozu in?
Well, Wim Wenders is a huge fan of Ozu. He's made no bones about that. So you can always sort of look for that kind of sensibility in his movies. But he doesn't copy Ozu. He just kind of borrows that idea of the small moment photographed in a very beautiful way. I do like the way Ozu has sort of staked out this particular type of intro. You know it's an Ozu movie because it has that burlap. And then the credits in the beginning, you get to find out everybody who's in it at the beginning instead of the credits at the end. So that's you know, one of the hallmarks of his films that, I mean, nobody's really done that.
And so it was in one of the people I read that was they ranked it as their favorite all-time favorite film was Paul Schrader, and you know he was the writer for Taxi Driver and a couple of other films. So it's interesting that the writer of Taxi Driver would write Tokyo Story, something completely different than Taxi Driver, as his all-time favorite movie.
That is interesting because Taxi Driver is almost always completely, totally in motion at all times, and it gives you that sense of disorientation because the camera is always moving.
And so for the listeners who, you know, like who kind of, like me, and I'm actually probably asking it for myself too, and I've only seen two, maybe somebody who hasn't seen any Ozu films, what would you say is like a good, you know, way to get into his movies? And then for people who have seen a couple, what's their best ways to continue for the other stuff they haven't seen?
Well, I think the Noriko trilogy is a good place to start because it gives you an idea of how he handles the same sort of story three different ways. I mean, that's not the exact same story. But those three films are Early Summer, Late Spring, and Tokyo Story. And if you watch all three of those, you get an idea. You'll see the sameness in some of his stories. You'll see the things that people say, oh, that's so Ozu, the vertical shots of smokestacks and of telephone poles. And then trains coming in from the left to the right, or trains going in from the right to the left. He plays with that direction a lot. And then there's always those scenes in the house where you're looking down hallways. He loves hallways. He photographs lots and lots of scenes like that, where you're sort of in the room, you're sort of seeing into a house, kind of into the personal space.
And so I understand getting a little bit off topic, but he also did, he goes way back. He went back to films in the silent era. So I like silent movies. So what one or two films in that silent era of his career would you say are really good?
There is a collection of crime comedies that he did he was actually pretty good at doing comedies, and then he sort of went into drama afterwards and then made years and years of dramatic films. There have been a couple of films he's made in his later career, one or two that had comic moments. But he never really returned to that sort of sensibility from the silent era. So I would look up the crime dramas first and see if you like them.
And so if people are wondering where to find them, I believe all this stuff is on the Criterion Collection?
Not everything is available, but you can certainly find them what is available on Criterion. And they always have the best transfer and the best subtitling. So if you can, get a Criterion copy.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I like about Criterion is they always, you know, they have the subtitles and then it's original language. Because my one pet peeve is foreign films that are dubbed over in English because the audio just gets on my nerves because it's so distracting.
Also with Criterion, if they have any behind the scenes or commentary, they'll have that included. They certainly have it for Tokyo Story and for Late Spring, which are both very famous works of his. But not all the other ones have that. You just have the movie, but that's good enough.
Yeah, and so, you know, getting a little bit more unrelated, you know, in this time of, you know, Japanese cinema, you had, you know, Ozu in the 40s and 50s, you had Kurosawa dominating, and you also, you know, a little bit more commercial, but, you know, had the very first Godzilla film, which I also talked about, Giuliano. That was a great movie. So you think that this era in Japanese cinema was the golden age?
You know, Japanese cinema got in really early. I mean, this particular studio started in 1895 that he used. And so they were not latecomers at all. They kind of helped pave the way for what was to come. I don't know if I would call this the golden age because there's so much going on in there. But it's certainly the golden age for that particular type of movie. He really dominated that particular kind of story and told it over and over in a really good way.
Okay. So we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything we haven't covered or I missed that you want to bring up or talk about now?
Well, one thing that's always kind of fun about watching Ozu is how things have changed in ways he couldn't have anticipated. It's ironic to see all these men playing Mahjong because you think of it as something women play. It's a woman's game now. Somewhere along the line that changed. It's just one of those dated little things that you see, and it's like, oh, that's the Ozu thing. Pretty soon they're going to break out the sake. And then they're going to start singing the old war songs. That's another thing that happens over and over in an Ozu movie.
So what is, a bit unrelated, what is sake again?
Sake is rice wine. Rice everything. Everything's made with rice, if possible. And, the famous wine is made from rice.
I definitely have to try that out sometime. Okay. So last question I'll have for you is just tell us a little bit about the classes you teach.
Well, this fall 2016, I will be teaching Introduction to World Cinema. I will be teaching French cinema. And I will be teaching film and philosophy with Helen Mitchell.
Interesting. My dad teaches at the Naval Academy, and philosophy and film is also one of the courses he teaches.
Maybe he should guest in my class.
Could you two collaborate? Yeah. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Yasujiro Ozu and his 1953 classic Tokyo Story. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying so long, and we will see you next week.